Hi, this is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Today, what does the weed killer atrazine have to do with your city's drinking water? Well, a lot.
We actually test it every day during runoff season in spring because we know that the atrazine is coming, so we measure it more frequently.
Harvest Public Media looks at how runoff from farming affects urban water districts. Matt Bachman has combined his scientific work with his love of brewing. We hear about his plan to harvest wild strains of yeast and make them available to home and craft brewers alike. In the kitchen, it's curry.
And this is going to be a vegan dish, so vegans unite.
First news from the week with Mark Chilla.
This first story, Annie, was announced last week. Purdue Farms says it has eliminated all antibiotics from its chicken supply, making it the first major poultry supplier to do so. Back in 2007, the Maryland-based company eliminated antibiotics from its chicken feed. In 2014, they announced its hatching chicks were antibiotic-free. And that same year, the company also stopped using on its chickens antibiotics also used to treat people. Purdue will continue to use antibiotics to treat sick flocks, but they've replaced preventative antibiotics at their 13 million chicken operation with vaccines, probiotics, and re-engineered chicken barns. Other chicken suppliers are taking steps to face the pressure to reduce antibiotic use in their supplies. Tyson Foods is the largest U.S. meat company by sales, and it says it will stop using antibiotics used to treat humans on chickens by the end of September 2017. The World Health Organization is urging governments around the world to tax soda and other sugary drinks. In its report, the WHO points to systemic reviews of policies aimed at improving diet and preventing lifestyle diseases, such as obesity and diabetes. Dr. Douglas Betcher is the director of the WHO's Department for the Prevention of Noncommunicable Diseases. He says that, quote, consumption of free sugars, including products like sugary drinks, is a major factor in the global increase of people suffering from obesity and diabetes, unquote. In a press release, he goes on to say that taxes on sugary drinks would cut healthcare costs and save lives. The International Council of Beverages, which represents soda companies and other beverage makers around the globe, says it's disappointed with the new WHO report. Philadelphia passed a tax on sweetened beverages earlier this year. Similar measures are on the ballot this year in San Francisco and Oakland, California, and Boulder, Colorado. Researchers documented a decline in the sales of sugary drinks in Mexico after a tax was passed there in 2014. And the latest installment of Mayogate. The USDA has ruled that the American Egg Board acted inappropriately when it carried out a two-year media campaign against Hampton Creek, the maker of an egg-free mayonnaise. The USDA also concluded that AEB officials tried to cover up their conduct by deleting emails. The American Egg Board was created in 1974 after the passage of the Egg Research and Consumer Information Act and became effective in 1976 after implementation of the Egg Research Promotion Order. Joanne Ivey, the board's former CEO, stepped down last year after the USDA opened its investigation. There's always more to read at eartheats.org. These stories go on our Twitter feed first, and we hope you'll connect with us there, too. That's at EarthEats.
Mark Chilla, reading the work of our bloggers Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo. See you, Mark.
Till next time.
Agriculture is often blamed for the pollution in Midwestern rivers and streams, but there are other culprits for our dirty waters. Today, in the fourth installment of our series, Watching Our Water, Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe looks at how cities respond to that pollution and create some of it, too.
Standing on a platform above the Missouri River at the Kansas City Water Services intake plant is like being on the deck of a large ship. Electric turbines create a hum you can feel as you grip the railing. Water the color of chocolate milk is sucked up and forced through screens below.
And the Missouri River drains 1/6 of the United States, so there's a lot of stuff that can affect the water quality in the river.
David Green is lab manager at KC Water. He says enough water to supply Kansas City with drinking water for a day flows by this point every 17 minutes. It's his job to make sure that enormous volume of water is clean. The most frequently detected contaminant, he says, is bacteria from sewage dumped in upstream. But there's also the annual problem of atrazine, the popular weed killer that's among the most common contaminants in U.S. waters. It's used mostly on cornfields.
But we actually test it every day during runoff season in the spring because we know that the atrazine is coming, so we measure it more frequently.
Cities forced to clean up polluted runoff from farms upstream are growing more vocal about the problem. In Iowa, the Des Moines Water Works has filed a federal lawsuit hoping to force three drainage districts to place more regulations on farmers. Toledo, Ohio has also seen huge problems. Yet in Kansas City, Green says he's seeing about 25% less atrazine in the water than in the past. He credits better management practices by farmers. Cities and suburbs play a part in water pollution, too. The problems are varied. We can point to our perfect lawns and golf courses and wonder about all the stuff it takes to keep them so green. Often, it's pesticides. A stunning 90% of U.S. urban streams contained concentrations of pesticides that could hurt aquatic life, according to a study by the U.S. Geological Survey.
It's a general rule that what you find in the environment is frequently a reflection of what you use.
Barbara Mahler is a research hydrologist with the Geological Survey. But those who are critical of farm country should also look at their own backyard. Literally. Glyphosate, what we know as Roundup, is the number two seller in what's called the home and garden sector, and millions of pounds of the product is used every year.
The fact that we use atrazine much more heavily in rural areas and agricultural areas than in urban areas is reflected by what we find in the streams, and the fact that we use a lot of glyphosate in urban areas is also reflected in what we find in the streams.
Another issue, the dramatic Midwestern storms often overload storm water systems, or in some cities, that system is just old. Karen Flournoy of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says stormwater is a big contributor to urban water pollution.
We have streets, driveways, buildings. So when it rains and all of that runoff carries a variety of pollutants, and it carries sediment, it can carry chemicals, pesticides, oil, just a variety of constituents that end up in the streams.
Storm water systems aren't sexy, but they are a big deal. 6 years ago, Kansas City settled a lawsuit brought by the U.S. Justice Department for violations of the Clean Water Act. The city promised to spend $2.5 billion over the next 25 years to reduce pollution levels in urban stormwater.
That's the Missouri River from this morning.
Back at David Green's lab at KC Water Services, he holds up a gallon jug filled with water pulled from the Missouri River that morning for testing. He says he does hundreds of tests a day. Meanwhile, the Geological Survey recently did some of the first testing for glyphosate in urban streams, some south of Kansas City, and we'll learn the results in a couple months. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Watching Our Water is a special series from Harvest Public Media. Next week in Part 5, we'll explore new research into fighting water pollution. Read more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Indiana gardeners, I wonder if you have the same assessment of this season as Daniel Orr does.
It has been wet, but it's been great. Everything is still going. You know, usually your beans and your tomatoes and your okra and everything kind of die out at the end of August, but everything's still going strong. I'm still getting squash blossoms, so it's been a fun year in the garden.
How's zucchini been?
Zucchini has been overwhelming, as it tends to be. You know, you're so excited when those first few start coming on there. You know, you pick them when they're nice and small and everything, and they're delicious. And then all of a sudden, you find that gigantic one that's been hiding under a zucchini leaf, and then all hell breaks loose, and you're leaving them on people's doorsteps and all kinds of stuff.
The great late summer zucchini drop. Maybe another tactic would be to make this recipe and then bring it to the office or a pitch-in.
Daniel has cooked up some wheat berries to go with the veggies.
Basically, it's the whole wheat kernel. So when you put them out like that on a plate, they're going to be hard. They almost look like rice, like a brown rice. What you'll notice is when you cook them, they take quite a while to cook, about 45 minutes to an hour. They're going to pop up, and they're going to be kind of like a soft popcorn kernel almost. If you want to give them a little taste, they're kind of crunchy. And as you chew them, the flavor kind of develops, and you get kind of the sweetness. All right, so we're over at the stove now, and I've got kind of a nice wide bottom pan, and we're going to start with the garlic. And I've got about a couple tablespoons of garlic. I love garlic, so. Okay, and you want to cook that until it's just a little bit brown, and it'll start to smell kind of toasty. And at that point, we're going to add the shallots. Okay, and the zucchini, which we've diced, and the nice carrots, which we've cut into rondelles, and about three or four scallions. Cook this until it just becomes tender, because we want to have a little bit of texture to our salad. I'm going to season these with some salt and pepper. And then another favorite Earth Eats ingredient is our lemon zest. Okay, and that's really all it takes. We don't need to cook it very long. I'm going to go back over, back into the bowl. To that amount, we're going to add about 3 cups of cooked wheat berries, about a cup of feta cheese, just roughly crumbled, and then we've got some cherry tomatoes. Okay, we're going to give that a toss. Okay, and you can see a very, very pretty salad. Let me give it a taste. Really a great combination of textures. You could also, instead of the feta, you could add tofu if you wanted to keep it vegan. All right, and let me dish this out.
We've got a detailed description of how to whip this up at eartheats.org. Now, his okra plants are also still going strong.
It's one of those plants, it takes a little while to get going in the garden. It will just kind of sit there, and you're like, come on, guy, let's go. And then all of a sudden, once that heat hits, you know, we'll start really popping in July and really fruit in August. And then, you know, I mean, we have these hot days here. It's still popping up like crazy, and we'll get it probably until the first frost.
Last week, he made some pickled okra that's now ready to be opened up and devoured. Here's a curry recipe that cooks up in a jiff if you're looking for a dinner idea for tonight.
So we're going to start with a nice hot pan, about a quarter cup of olive oil. Okay, and now we're going to add the okra. I'm just, you know, this is nice, tender, young okra. So we're just going to toss it. We want to have the texture of the okra stay a little bit crunchy. We don't want to cook it a long time. So we're just getting it nice and hot. We're going to add our ginger and about 2 tablespoons of chopped fresh garlic. Right now I'm going to add some cider vinegar. This is a quarter cup of cider vinegar. And again, that's going to help keep that sliminess to a minimum. All right, we're going to add about a tablespoon of Madras curry, a couple cups of chickpeas. Now we're going to add the fresh vegetables, which are our multicolored sweet peppers or bell peppers, and tomatoes. They're going to make a nice, pretty color. And this is going to be a vegan dish. So, vegans unite. We're going to actually use coconut milk instead of cream or dairy product in this. Okay, I'm going to bring that up to high heat again and season it with some salt and pepper. Then we'll let it reduce just a little bit. Annie, this is going to be good. about 5 minutes of cooking. I've got some nice jasmine rice, really good with curries. Spiciness of the curry and then the mild flavor of the rice. And with a few black and white sesame seeds on the rice, we're good to go.
Okra, chickpeas, peppers, and tomatoes in a curry. At eartheats.org, I was curious, so I searched the word curry. And in our archives, we have a lentil curry and another take on a veggie curry. Go take a look and let us know which recipes you like best. Our email is eartheats@gmail.com. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. It's hard for grocery stores to survive in small rural communities, but a unique store in a tiny town in north central Nebraska is in its third year of operation because of who owns and operates it. For Harvest Public Media, Mike Tobias travels to Cody, home of the Circle C Market.
Thursdays, staff at the Circle C Market check what's in stock and decide what's to order. Erin Cheney is produce coordinator.
I'm looking to see what we have a lot of, what we don't have very much of. So I'm ordering more celery because we only have 4 packages.
Can I have the meat department, please?
In a cramped backroom office, Brittany Doherty calls the grocery store's food supplier.
This is Circle C Market, and we were wondering about ordering family-sized turkeys.
While Sydney Adamson works on a computer.
I'm entering all the daily work in QuickBooks.
The handful of Circle C staffers finish their hour of work and go back to school. Yes, back to Cody Kilgore School, a couple blocks away, where Adamson and the others are students.
Student-run grocery store, that's not very common.
Rare, in fact, although nationally there are a couple other school-run nonprofit grocery stores like Circle C. How did this happen in Cody? First, a little background. The village sits atop Cherry County, a sparsely populated chunk of Sandhills Ranch land bigger than the entire state of Connecticut. Just 156 people call Cody home, not a prime location for any retail business. Cody's previous grocery store closed more than a decade ago.
It started through a brainstorming session actually here at the school long before I was here.
Says Todd Chesmore, who was attracted to the Cody Kilgore School superintendent job because of the Circle C project.
And a couple teachers said, kind of as a joke, we need to have a grocery store. Well, as the discussion went on, that joke turned into, well, let's see what we can do.
They turned a crazy idea into reality, involving students and community members from the beginning. The USDA and other groups helped with startup funds and planning. After a few years of discussion and debate, they were ready to break ground. Then it took a few months and lots of volunteers to construct the unique 3,500-square-foot building, which has walls filled with straw for insulation. The Circle C finally opened for business about 2.5 years ago. Here's how it works. A board of community members oversees the nonprofit operation. Chesmore is executive director. During the school day, students take on tasks at the store as part of different classes, with a paid adult employee and teachers on hand to help train and supervise. The rest of the time, students are paid to work at Circle C.
The store is truly run by students. We have adults that are involved, but essentially we try and get the kids to do pretty much everything.
Jess Moore says, and that's everything from elementary school students decorating grocery bags to high schoolers deciding to stock a new cereal.
So we could also do one to replace the crisp rice because I don't think anyone's going to buy that.
No, it never sells. Yeah,
we have rows and rows of that.
Adamson, a sophomore, schedules workers and has been known to cover an open shift at the last minute. Not easy when you live 45 miles from town.
Most people wouldn't think it'd work, and the students are doing most of the work. We have supervisors, but it's on us. And so it's just, there's a lot of mistakes made, but everything is fixable, and we're getting through it, and it's growing and doing well.
The store did about $250,000 of business last year. Chessmore says the operation is self-sustaining and in the black, but not by much, and primarily because of how it's run.
Without the school being as intimately involved as it is, I don't think it could be done. It cannot generate enough funds and still be competitive to stay open.
What doesn't show up on the Circle C ledger is how the village and its people benefit from having a local grocery store that's not an hour round trip away. But there are jobs, but there are also the jobs and experiences for students.
One of my favorite classes,
says 8th grader Lizzie Hooper.
If I ever want to learn a business, I know what to put on the shelves, how to put it on the shelves, how to finance, how to get grants, and marketing and advertising.
Adamson, who will manage the store this summer, says Circle C helps her prepare for a possible future in accounting. But she's learned more by being involved in the process from the start.
And the store has really taught me to, never take the first no. Like, there's always a solution. And people will tell you no, and you just got to keep working and don't give up.
An attitude reflected throughout a tiny town that calls itself Too Tough to Die. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Mike Tobias.
The story originally aired in February of this year. There are photos and a video that go with it. Find them at harvestpublicmedia.org. What is yeast? Matt Bachman says it's the simplest type of organism that's like a human cell. As a molecular and cellular biochemist, he's been working with these one-celled fungi in the lab for about 15 years.
So all of the same machinery that keeps us going is the same thing that keeps a yeast cell going. So you can use yeast to make a lot of things. So antibodies and antibiotics and things that are, you know, clinically used were developed in yeast a lot of times and produced in yeast. So you can do a lot with a tiny little organism.
Yeast is also that thing that turns that dark brown, woody-smelling tea brewers call wort into alcoholic beer. He's now bringing his scientific research to the beer community with his business Wild Pitch Yeast. As it is, brewers these days use just a few of the hundreds of thousands of varieties of yeast out there in nature. Bachman wants to expand the varieties of yeast brewers have access to and help make a truly local brew. And in this case, he says local could mean literally your backyard.
Commercial yeast is great. I mean, it's the gold standard. It's what everybody uses because it works consistently and reliably. It is expensive, though, especially for people that aren't on the West Coast, where for right now, that's where the big yeast labs are. So a brewery in Indiana might spend $600 to buy a quantity of yeast to make a big batch of beer. But the shipping on that yeast is $700. So there's a huge hit from just being, you know, geographically far from these places. The other thing is that most of the commercially available strains out there are all of European origin. These were things that, you know, maybe German immigrants brought with them when they started breweries in the U.S. or people that have traveled to Belgium and places like that just brought back with them. So if you really want to make an all-American beer, you need an all-American yeast.
35-year-old is an assistant professor at Indiana University. His interest in studying yeast started right around the time he fermented his first beverage, when he was in college in rural Pennsylvania. The raw apple cider he bought from an Amish farmer had yeast in it naturally, so making hard cider was pretty easy, he remembers. Then he got into homebrewing when he had more time on his hands in grad school, and he would just experiment. What would it taste like to throw a cup of blackberries in a wheat beer? And what about the different tastes of the different yeasts? He says the strain of yeast you put in a beer can have a significant influence on the taste. It can affect the alcohol content and the cloudiness of a beer, too. Since he was working in a yeast lab at the University of Pittsburgh, he had access to lots of different varieties.
So I've taken home lab yeast and used that to make beer with. And at one point, I'd created a strain that expressed a human kidney protein. And I figured, well, I might as well throw this into some beer. And, you know, the amount of human protein in that beer was incredibly infinitesimal, but we called it Soylent Stout and Cannibal Stout and all these things. It was actually really good.
You want to make a beer with the yeast from your kid's hair? Well, Matt can help you do that. Yeast is everywhere, he says, on this microphone, on tree bark, on the world's highest mountains. Having that spirit of experimentation, he started harvesting yeast from all over the place to see what beer brewing strains were out there.
We just take some kind of environmental sample. Again, pick your favorite weird object in your field of view, and we bring it back into the lab, and we've devised a special medium that selects for and enriches for yeasts and basically selects against everything else. So there's bacteria and filamentous fungus and all that stuff out there. And so through a series of just sort of commonplace microbiological techniques, we can go from a soil sample, for instance, to, you know, five or six pure strains in under a week. And then we can freeze those guys down. We can figure out what species they are using molecular techniques. We can start to brew with them, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out that it's very, very easy to find yeast that you can make beer with. I mean, we've found them everywhere, literally everywhere that we've looked. In just a few months, we gathered 300 strains, and we could have had 3,000 strains. We literally had to stop ourselves because the problem is the proof is in the brewing, right? You can run a bunch of lab tests and say this, that, and the other thing about them, but until you actually taste what they make, you can never say, oh, this is going to be a great IPA yeast or a great English ale yeast or whatever it is.
So that means there's a shelf in his lab with about 40 bottles of beer in the making. Fermentation takes 2 weeks, then carbonation takes another 2 weeks. So he's in the cycle of tasting new beers every 2 weeks. And his goal is to test out 250 different strains of yeast to see which works best with which styles of beer. He'll then catalog them on the Wild Pitch Yeast website with descriptions of the flavor profiles. And actually, Bachman says that's been the toughest part, developing his sense of smell and taste to write up a proper definition of the yeasts.
There's not a one-to-one correlation with where we collect the yeast and the flavors we get, though. An apple yeast doesn't necessarily give you aromatic and flavor notes of apple or fruit. And vice versa. If we have a soil sample, you're not going to end up necessarily with something that's got an earthy sort of flavor to it. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's just luck of the draw. We've got one strain that's got this tremendous sort of fresh strawberry aroma and flavor, like not just the fruit itself, but you get a little bit of like the greenery with it. And it came from just a spontaneous fermentation that we did. So Mother Nature sprinkled that one in from who knows where. And that was a pleasant surprise.
Wild Pitch Yeast is also looking to crowdsource. They'll send you a kit to harvest your own. They'll process it in the lab, tell you what you need to know about the strains they find, and then they'll sell you enough yeast to make a 50-gallon batch of beer if you like. Now, that's drinking local. Matt Bachman is an assistant professor in molecular and cellular biochemistry at Indiana University. The website is wildpitchyeast.com. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Glad for your company today. I'm Annie Corrigan.